Welcome to our Farming Water Scotland podcast series. Over this series, we're looking at various mitigation options, guidance and farmers' experience to help manage and improve water quality on the farm and surrounding area. You can listen back to all previous episodes in this series and other podcasts we produce for the Farming Water Scotland on any podcast provider. Today we're focusing on ditches, drainage and dredging. I'm Fiona Salter, an environmental consultant for SEC Consulting and host for today's podcast. Today we're joined by Alistair Matheson, a senior hydromorphologist, and Graham Henderson, water permitting unit manager from SEPA, and Peter Lindsay, the Southeast Regional Development Manager from SEC Consulting. Thank you all for joining us today. In this podcast, we'd like to discuss water flow on farm and how farmers can gain help and reassurance to manage this flow while complying with regulations of good practice. Alistair and Graham, do you want to discuss what guidelines and regulations farmers need to comply with in regard to ditches, drainage and dredging? Basically, what can a farmer do?
Most of the work is controlled by the Controlled Activities Regulations, which is generally just known as CAR. And that sets out the kind of standards that we're aiming for farmers and other land managers to meet when they're undertaking dredging works or any other engineering works. So it's split into a kind of range of risk levels. Starting at the lowest, you've got general binding rules, which are exactly what they say. It's a set of rules that if you follow, you don't need to speak to SEPA, providing you stick to them. Moving up from that, you've got registrations, which again are relatively low risk activities, and really all we're doing there is asking for notification that you're doing it, and again there'll be another set of rules that you've got to follow that comes out with those. And then beyond that, you're moving into licensed territory, where it's for bigger, higher risk works, and again that's split into two categories, with the majority of things being a simple license and then only really big works being in the complex end. And basically, the further up the scale that you go, the more complicated it gets, the more information we need, simply because the risk to the environment increases along those lines. So that's where we are with those. Kind of in terms of what you need to do to find out with that, it's probably looking at, there's a document called CAR Practical Guide, and it sets everything out. And all of the dredging works we call sediment management, just because it's not all about just purely dredging. It can be doing other activities in the river. So there's just a discrete section there, and the activities are laid out. So depending what you want to do, you see where it fits in with the different activities in that table, and then that lets you decide, you know, what you're doing. I mean, what we're always trying to encourage people to do is do the minimum and stay down at the bottom end of the scale, because things just get a lot more complicated once you get into licensed territory.
You mean the following the GBRs?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Thanks. So there are practices on farm that farmers can do without having to actually contact SEPA?
There's quite a lot that can be done. We've, over the years, we've kind of adapted the activities to try and make it easier for farmers to do lower risk activities without needing to contact us. So there's a number of GBRs that let a lot of common work being done. So probably one of the most useful ones is when it comes to straightened watercourses that are narrow. So one of the problems we have is the definition between what's a drain and what's just a straightened watercourse.
Yeah.
And that can be difficult, because even though it's been straightened and it might be considered a drain by the landowner, if it's actually been a natural watercourse at some point, then we know we're interested in it. So pure drainage works, where there has never been a watercourse before, we don't need any authorization. There's not even any GBRs. Your only requirement is to make sure you don't cause pollution downstream where that enters a watercourse. But then we have options for straightened burns, where if it's narrow and it's got a silty bed, it's a GBR that allows you to work there. For larger things, you can get a registration, and albeit you need to apply for that. Again, it's at that bottom end of the scale, so it shouldn't be too difficult to get. And then there's other GBRs that let you clear out at the end of culverts or behind a weir, move sediment away from field drain outfalls that are getting blocked. So that there's a lot of little bits and pieces that can be done without needing to come to us. But I guess I would always say, if you're in doubt, just speak to your local CBOT office and they'll be able to give you a bit of guidance.
Thanks, Ben. We will put links to all the guidance that we've just mentioned and we'll mention throughout this podcast, beside the podcast online. So looking at over the past few years, we've seen an increase in, or I feel that we've seen an increase in extreme weather events, from intense rainfall to drought to severe winds. Is this likely to continue?
Yeah, so I would say the short answer is yes. I think, like you've alluded to, people's practical experience, and there's plenty of kind of evidence and statistics kicking around in the media recently. You know, how many times have we heard in the news that it's been the warmest or driest or wettest day or month or year on record? So, and when you look at Met Office website and their climate change stuff, you know, there's some pretty clear trends there that are pointing to this continuing. Again, like you've said, kind of we all kind of, I think, are observing it ourselves, and not only just our sort of day-to-day practical experiences of it, but we're having conversations quite regularly with some of the sort of big infrastructure operators in Scotland, likes of Network Rail and Transport Scotland and local authorities, who are all kind of reporting more in terms of flooding and damage to their infrastructure around about river crossings, which is kind of speaking to the kind of increase in change I think we're seeing. So, and again, coming back to the predictions, the climate change predictions for Scotland are that we're going to have wetter winters and drier summers, but in the summer, we're like, when rainfall comes, it's likely to be more intense. So yeah, that's a slightly longer answer. We're likely to see this continue, and actually it's going to get worse as well, if predictions are followed.
So moving on from, what will this mean for how rivers and burns function?
So the predictions of wetter winters and more intense rainfall in the summers basically means that we're going to see more frequent high flows in our rivers, and the magnitude of those high flows is also going to increase. There's been quite a bit of work done on this for flooding purposes, and the current predictions are that by the end of this century, the peak flood flows will increase. It varies across Scotland, but typically speaking, peak flood flows are going to increase by off the order of 40 to 50%, which is quite a large number. Mm-hmm. And in terms of rivers, that increase in rainfall pretty much directly relates to, the increase in flows directly in relates to an increase in energy in our river systems. And energy is one of the sort of fundamental drivers of how rivers function. Flowing water creates energy, and it's just sort of basic physics, that energy has to be used up as water flows from the hills down back down to the sea. That energy has to get used up somehow. So one of the key mechanisms that rivers use to dissipate that energy during high flows is by eroding and transporting sediment. And what I mean by sediment is the kind of material that's on the bed and banks of the river. So quite often after big floods, you'll see obviously lots of erosion, and you'll have seen gravel moving around in the river. So rivers are constantly adjusting due to these fluctuations in energy, and that climate change driven significant increase in energy that we're expecting, and I would say we're currently experiencing at least the start of it, means that our rivers are going to change more. Mm-hmm. And they're going to change to a sort of greater extent than perhaps we've been used to in our kind of recent living experience. And rivers are complex systems, so they change from, you know, headwaters to the sea. And the changes that we're going to see will be different in different parts of the river. So in some places we might see quite a significant increase in erosion, and in other places we might see, you know, significant increases in deposition of sediment or accumulation of sediment in the river channel. And in some places where maybe we haven't seen much change in the past, they might start to change more than we've seen before.
So what can land managers do to mitigate these changes to become more resilient in the future? So obviously the changes are going to happen.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I was really interested that you used the word resilient in the question. It's a bit of a buzzword at the moment. So I went to the SNFR flood conference that was held in February this year, and the Cabinet Secretary for Transport, Net Zero and Transition, Mary McCallan, spoke at that conference about trying to move away from fixing flooding problems to making places more resilient to flooding, in recognition of the fact that climate change is happening, and it's happening quickly now, and we need to build more resilient places effectively. So in terms of how do we make rivers more resilient to these changes, what we've got to think about is, rather than treating the symptom, which is kind of the erosion and deposition that we see happening, try to sort of address the main cause, which is the increase in system energy, which is going to be quite significant. So I guess how do we do that? I've kind of spoken about how rivers dissipate energy by transporting sediment. That's one of the key things. There are kind of a couple other ways that rivers get rid of energy in flood flows. One is by spreading the flow, so using floodplains. And I suppose the analogy I would use there is, if you think about what happens when you put your finger over the end of a hose pipe, when you're like constraining the flow and keeping it hemmed in, you're kind of speeding it up and giving it more energy. Whereas if you let it spread, it tends to go slower and have less energy. So spreading flow is an important way of dissipating energy, but also sort of vegetation on the banks and on the floodplain, and sometimes in the channel as well, is, if you think about that as being resistant to flow, water has to work harder to get past it and through it. So that's using up energy. So there's two ways we can try and address this increase in energy. I'm not saying this is going to be easy by any means. And so ways to absorb and dissipate energy is really what I would suggest we should be trying to do in our river systems. So I guess creating more space where we can to help high flows spread out a little bit, and increasing vegetation on the banks particularly, not only does it help to dissipate flows, but it helps to sort of bind banks together as well. So an example of this would be maybe extended buffer strips. And of course, you guys all know that these bring more than just the benefit of dealing with that increased energy. There's the benefits of improved biodiversity, water quality, carbon capture, and kind of mitigation of flooding and drought as well.
Yeah. My next question, like based on what we've just discussing, is about dredging. And in light of what we've been discussing, would dredging help?
That's quite a difficult question to answer, just because rivers are so complex, and it very much depends on how a river is functioning at any point in the river system and what problem we're trying to address. So I'm not saying no, dredging is never the answer. In terms of flooding purely, there's quite a lot of studies out there being done that kind of generally show that flooding doesn't have a lot of benefit. Dredging doesn't have a lot of benefit to flooding. Those are typically in the sort of the local authority schemes in sort of built up areas. But SEPA and the NFUS, after the floods in 2016, we did a bit of work on three sites, one on the River Dee in Aberdeenshire, one on the Tay, and one on the Spey as well. Looking specifically at the sort of connection between the buildup of gravel sediment in rivers and flooding of adjacent agricultural land. So we did three specific case studies, and on two of those sites we did quite detailed modelling, which both demonstrated that actually removing quite a large amount of sediment from the river didn't actually make much difference at all to the flooding situation. And often, and again, it's there are definitely situations. The other site that we didn't actually model, and there's kind of, we didn't really have to model that site, that was on the Spey, because we kind of knew just by looking at the site that it was heavily depositional. So by that I mean it was obvious that gravel was accumulating in this reach of river. And of course, if the river's got nowhere to go and gravel is building up in the river, then it's kind of obvious that it's going to have less capacity to carry water. So that was a site where we concluded that, yes, dredging would be one way to deal with that situation. But I would always encourage people to think about other ways, and we'll maybe come back to this when we talk about a case study later on, another case study later on. Mm-hmm. But I guess the thing I would say is dredging can often trigger other changes in rivers. So it can increase erosion upstream and downstream. And in the long run, just sort of make the whole situation worse and potentially pass problems upstream and downstream. So it's really careful. Even if we conclude that dredging is the way to go, it's really important that we kind of understand what the effects of that's going to be, and try to think about other ways of potentially dealing with the problem as well.
So site specific.
It's very site specific.
The right place, the right dredge, and the right.
Exactly.
Thank you. So Peter, moving on to on the ground, what issues have farmers encountered from following the guidance and regulations, and where do the issues lie with landowners or farmers that you have corresponded with or heard stories about?
Yeah, so in the first instance, I think the issues often arise is that the industry isn't necessarily aware of what they can actually do without CEPA involvement. Yeah, it's just getting that information across that they can actually clean out small ditches under a meter bed width, and a lot of general maintenance can be done. I think there's maybe a slight fear out there of being caught doing something that's not right to the extent that they end up just doing nothing, and a little bit of this maintenance could help let the water run at the right times. A lot of what Alistair has just explained about there has been very visual in certainly in this area in the last number of months over the winter. We've seen the whole range from crops lost in the fields, whether it's potatoes that were not harvested before the rain, the big rain started coming. The new sown crops, which were flooded and rotted out in the fields, channels gouged out across fields with soil erosion, just with the pure volume of water coming down, debris, such as branches and trees coming down water courses and getting blocked under bridges or narrow parts of the water courses. Burst flood banks, eroded riversides, farm tracks getting washed out that effectively got turned into water courses in their own right, and also the gravel deposits left in fields where the river has effectively spilled out and then slowed down and dropped that down. So yeah, I think there's been a big education in what water can do and the power of water. Mm-hmm. So it's risen right up the awareness. There's been houses flooded out, whether it's towns, villages, or a house on a farm, and often the landowner can get some of the blame if they've not cleaned out a water course. sometimes they can get the blame if they have cleaned out a water course. So it's just trying to do the right thing, and I think it's come across there. It's not the same solution in every instance. So yeah, it's just trying to work with. I think you're right. Speaking to CEPA and working with them is probably the best approach.
And again, it's like case by case, because no farm is the same. So, and it will, yeah, the storms last year were quite something, and the frequency of them as well, the amount of water that people were having to deal with.
Yeah, I think the law of averages, we were expecting to be dry by now, but it's still raining. But yeah, we've certainly seen, like, it's 100 mil rainfall events time after time all winter, which certainly I've never seen before. But yeah, as explained, it's likely to become more the norm. So we'll need to start learning how to cope with it.
Yeah. Thanks, Peter. And then following on from Peter's comments, how can we all work together to ensure that the regulations and the guidance is followed, but also help farmers become more resilient? How, if that information is available online and is available, how can we make, like, connect the dots? If, like Peter's saying, that people haven't, or like the fear of doing something wrong, how can we reduce those barriers to make sure people are getting the information that they need and understanding the information that they need to know?
Yeah, I think there's always been this kind of tension between CEPA and, you know, and farmers and other landowners. And I suppose it's kind of stemmed from both sides, but I guess the message that we put across is that we're not trying to stop people doing things. We're just wanting them to do them in the right way. And, you know, we're happy to help people to do that and to talk through options with them and to try and, you know, facilitate so that they can do things. That it's a lot of what we do is just encouraging people to do what they need to do and not going too far. Quite often what we have is people applying for really big projects, and that becomes very complicated because the impact can be quite big. But if you can do more of the maintenance work more frequently and come and speak to us about that, then often that can be done without too much problems. And we are trying to improve our guidance and to make it more accessible, because we are aware that regulations can be quite complicated, and there's lots of little nuances in them, and it can be difficult, especially if you're not dealing with it day to day, to understand that. So really, if people want to come to speak to us, then we are happy to help out, because we'd much rather do that than, you know, as Peter says, find someone doing something that they shouldn't be doing because they've left it for so long and they're scared to speak to us. It's much better to speak to us up front. And we are always trying to improve and adapt the regulations and how we implement them to make it easier for people, because ultimately we want people to do the work in a sustainable way, and we don't want to spend too much of our time doing it, because we don't have all the time that we would like. Mm-hmm. And we've got to prioritize between different things. So if we can make it easy enough for people to understand without coming to us, then that makes our life easier, as well as the farmer who's trying to do the work.
And of CEPA, I want to see this week, well, they've just updated their website, and you've got a page dedicated to dredging. And we'll put links on the notes in here as well. And will that be an evolving page?
It will be an evolving page, yeah. It's just been put up, so it's got kind of links to a lot of the existing guidance, but as I think Alistair said earlier on, we are working on that and trying to improve that, so that it will be updated over the next few months. We are also working with NFUS in terms of trying to get some simple guides out to farmers as well, just to guide them through the process so they can see exactly when they need to come to us and when they don't.
An example of where we have kind of worked with landowners is on the Upper River Nairn at the Aberarder Estate. So this is an example of where it was quite a heavily modified bit of river, so it had been straightened and embanked on both sides, but it was heavily depositional, so again gravel was building up in the river channel, and this was causing issues to the land on both sides actually, because obviously the capacity of the river to carry water was getting less over time, and it would spill more regularly into the fields, and actually at some points it was starting to threaten property as well. So the landowner came to us and just really to find out what they needed to do in terms of the regulations. And we had a bit of a discussion at that point, and we ended up going out to have a look with the landowner. And after a bit of sort of assessment of the site and what was happening in the river and a bit of what was happening around about, we kind of identified there might be another way of dealing with the problem. And after kind of further work and some funding from SEPA, they kind of implemented a different approach. So rather than digging out the river to create the extra capacity, we actually diverted the river to a bit of land that was not as well used for agriculture, shall I say, but actually provided the river with quite a bit more space to do that kind of getting river energy and actually depositing the material. And yeah, it had the dual benefit of resolving the problem for the landowner, but also actually significantly improving the quality of that bit of river. So no longer is it as heavily modified as it used to be, and with all the habitat problems that had, it's now functioning much more naturally and is providing kind of better habitat, and actually through the planting of trees as well is helping to store carbon. So yeah, I think that was a bit of a win-win project, mm-hmm. And it just simply came through engagement with SEPA right from the outset.
What was the question for Peter about if there's anything he thinks that we could do better in terms of engagement?
I wonder if we could just summarise what can be done
for a lot of the kind of activities. If it's on the 1 to 50,000 OS map, it will need some form of authorization. But if it's not, it doesn't. Dredging is a bit different in that it pretty much always needs an authorization. But if you've got just like a field drain, an open field drain, and there's never been a watercourse there before, then that's just land drainage and you don't need anything. If you have a ditch that might be acting mainly as a drain for a field, but there used to be a burn there and it's just been straightened, providing that's less than 1 meter wide, then you just need to follow the general binding rule. So you don't need to come to us, you just have to follow those rules. And then stepping up from that, if that burn is between 1 meter and 5 meters wide, and it's got a silty or sandy bed, then you can get a registration. So again, that's like the lowest level of authorization, and that lets you take that out. And then there's other little bits roundabout. It's mainly roundabout other structures or drains where you can go in under the GBRs and make sure that structure is functioning. So like if you've got an outfall for a field drain, you can clear 5 meters round about it to make sure that it's not plugged as a GBR. I guess the one thing with the general binding rules is there's a condition in there about timing for fish. So generally we say kind of October to May is when fish are spawning, and ideally you shouldn't be in the watercourse at that time because that's the highest risk time. But if you can speak to your local fisheries board and they say there's no fish there to be spawning, then you can go in. But that's one of the key ones. So it's that timing one where people can get caught out. But there are, as I say, there's ways around. If there's no fish there and you get the fisheries board or some other qualified person to tell you there's no fish there, then you're okay and you can follow the rules. I think we would just like to emphasise that we are here to help, and that if any farmer or land manager does have any questions, then they should either contact their local SEPA team, or you can email waterpermitting@sepa.org.uk if you get any questions about registrations or licensing, and we can help with those.
Thank you, Alistair, Graham and Peter, for joining us today. It was really interesting, and I'm hoping it'll be really helpful for a lot of land managers out there. And thank you for joining us today. We'll save all the links to documents and guidance notes that have been discussed throughout this podcast on the webpage. If you've enjoyed listening, please like, subscribe and follow our podcast wherever you listen to them. And please get in touch if you'd like to find out more. Farming Water Scotland is funded by Scottish Government and delivered by SSE Consulting in partnership with SEPA to help farmers and land managers reduce diffusion pollution risk and benefit the farm business.